Señor Bayler, profesor, señor presidente del Consejo de Contas de Galicia, miembros del Consejo de Contas, señor presidente del Tribunal Gallego de Defensa de la Competencia, miembros de dicho tribunal, señor director del Instituto Gallego de Padre de Sarmiento, señor ex consejero Dositeo Rodríguez de la Presidencia, señoras y señores, muy buenos días. Como decía Henri Pirenne en su obra Mahoma y Carlomagno, Europa, tal como la conocemos hoy, nace realmente con la coronación de Carlomagno como Imperator Romanorum en el año 800. Los premios Carlomagno de la Unión Europea van precisamente por esa tesis. Esa Europa que nacía en el año 800 es efectivamente el resultado de tres fuentes principales: la grecolatina, la judeocristiana y la ilustrada. Hoy, gracias al profesor Bayler y gracias también a Aristóteles, a Aquino y a Maimónides, aprenderemos un poco más de estas fuentes, de donde aún mana la Europa que soñamos hoy. Esa Europa que aquel 16 de abril del año 1950 Jean Monnet diseñó en una cuartilla en su casa de campo del pueblo francés Montfort-l'Homerie, cuartilla que era el embrión de lo que habría de ser, andando el tiempo, la futura Unión Europea tal y como la conocemos en la actualidad. Desde aquel sueño han pasado más de medio siglo y de aquel núcleo primigenio de seis países se ha pasado nada menos que a 27 que la integran en la actualidad. Hoy, en el que de alguna manera sus primeros pasos se están dando con el Tratado de Lisboa, tratado que dota a la Unión de instituciones modernas y perfeccionando sus métodos de trabajo para poder afrontar con eficacia los desafíos del mundo de hoy. Otra vez los europeos vuelven su mirada a la Unión Europea para resolver los problemas como la crisis económica, la globalización, el cambio climático, la evolución demográfica, la seguridad y la energía, por enumerar algunos de ellos. Ante todos estos retos, estamos seguros que las palabras del profesor Bayler serán, de nuevo, una guía de perplejos, como fueron en su día las de nuestro compatriota cordobés Maimónides, que dio a la luz de su Talmud, ofreció a la eternidad una linterna que también en nuestros días alumbra nuestro camino. Como dice don Francisco Rubio Llorente, actual presidente del Consejo de Estado, en su prólogo a la obra del profesor Bayler, Una Europa Cristiana, el profesor Bayler, dice Rubio Llorente, es claramente perfectible un constante esfuerzo por construir una teoría normativa de la integración europea a partir de su espíritu, del impulso profundo que ha llevado a los europeos a unirse políticamente. Impulso que ha de comprenderse como una voluntad de unidad asentada sobre la conciencia de participar de una misma identidad, de constituir un demos, de formar parte de una comunidad ética diferenciada en el conjunto de la humanidad. Europa es, nos dice Bayler, un proyecto de comunidad política mejor, de sociedad mejor, una fórmula que hace pensar en la célebre definición orteguiana de nación. La integración europea se caracteriza por su telos específico, por su proyecto de sociedad mejor, una finalidad que contrasta con la que le asignan los realistas al estilo de Millward, que ven en la Europa unida más bien como un proyecto resignado de vida en común. Integración europea que era expresión de un problema real, problema para el que sigue siendo necesario encontrar una respuesta. Uno de los grandes méritos de Bayler, dice Rubio Llorente, es el de haber tenido la lucidez necesaria para percibir esa carencia teórica de la integración europea y la audacia bastante para denunciarla e intentar remediarla, adentrándose en lo que no es solo terra incógnita, sino campo minado, y todo ello con su admirable capacidad expresiva. No tengamos miedo, miremos como Jano hacia atrás para mejor poder ver hacia adelante, como perplejos que necesitamos guía otra vez de nuestros mayores. Muchas gracias, profesor Weiler, por venir a hablarnos de la virtud y de los valores de una, no, de una nueva Europa integrada, de una Europa unida. En este fin de Camino de las Estrellas, Camino de Santiago, que fue declarado itinerario cultural europeo por el Consejo de Europa y Patrimonio de la Humanidad por la UNESCO. Camino que vio tantos y tantos peregrinos que recibió el título de calle mayor de Europa. Esa Europa que, repetimos, bebe de las mismas fuentes que ayer, bebamos hoy y aquí de ella otra vez, porque son, como nuestro hebreo inmortal Maimónides, la mejor guía de perplejos. El profesor Weiler, cuyo currículum disponen de él en la carpetilla que hemos repartido, muy sucintamente lo voy a repetir para poner de relieve, aunque no es necesario.
Mia madre non è qui.
Thank you very much. All right. Thank you. Muchas gracias a todos. Tiene la palabra el profesor Weiler. Muchas gracias.
Thank you, Director. Thank you, President. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to have been invited, and it's also a great pleasure. It's also a great pleasure. You've heard this a million times, and you're used to it, and you've stopped seeing it, but it really is a most beautiful place. I always said that the most beautiful place, not one of the most beautiful places, but the most beautiful place I know in the world was Granada. But now I go home and I say we might have to revise. Next time I will come with my wife and we will make a decision.
Okay, thank you very much.
I apologize that I can't speak in Spanish. I promised myself to teach myself Spanish a few years ago. I could speak in French or in Italian or in Hebrew, shall I? Translate. But it's one of the many things that I've promised myself and I haven't done. So, and this lecture is going to have a very long introduction, like an insurance policy with all the small print. And then the lecture itself will, I promise you, be quite striking. So, the first part of the introduction. All my life, I have been a student of European integration, and I have characterized it, inter alia, as a noble experiment, as original, as inspiring, and something that has to be supported and sustained. Today I will offer some critical comments. And I know that the tendency in many places in Europe, the minute you make critical comments on the European Union, you are branded as anti-Europe. That's nonsense. I make critical comments of my wife, and I love her. I make critical comments of my children, and I adore them. They're wonderful. So there can be a critique that can come from a position of support, and I want my words to be understood in this way. It's not good for Europe if it polarizes and one has to defend everything that Europe does, etc. So that's my first introductory comment. The second is, I'm a lawyer. And law, in some ways, will be at the center of this lecture. But it's a non-instrumental approach to law. I want to explain what I mean by a non-instrumental approach to law. Usually we think correctly of law as an instrument. You have a policy, you want to stop pollution, you pass a law. And then there are two tasks. We have to understand what the law says, and sometimes it's not clear, that's how lawyers make money, to clarify when the law is not clear, etc. And then we have to measure if, as an instrument, the law is successful. Has it stopped pollution? Has it increased safety? Has it protected the environment? Has it deterred crime? It's an instrumental approach to law. Today's lecture is premised on a non-instrumental approach to law. So now I'm going to digress. But it's important. Let's say we were studying antiquity, or ancient Greece. How would we study ancient Greece? We would read a historian, but how would the historian study ancient Greece? So he or she would read old histories, Herodotus, for example, or Josephus Flavius, if he looks at ancient Rome. But they're not very reliable. So he would look at archaeology and old documents, and we would learn more. But everybody in the room would accept that he could also read Sophocles or Euripides, Antigone, Medea, or Homer, the Odysseus, the Iliad. That's fiction. That's not history. But we learn from the fiction on the moral sensibility, on the political culture of antiquity, what they admired, what they laughed at, what made them cry, how they defined their moral dilemmas. We can learn a lot about them. We also have another insight. When we read Homer and we read Sophocles and we read Euripides, we know that those things both reflect the culture, but they also shape the culture. They also constitute the culture. There's a bidirectional relationship. Now, law is not only instrumental. It is part of our culture. We can read law the way we read Euripides, the way we read Sophocles. I will give you an example to convince you. We today believe in a society which believes in solidarity, that poor people should be helped, that believes in justice, that judges should not be bribed, that we should treat the rich and the powerful in exactly the same way that we treat the poor and the weak, correct? That we have to treat aliens in a humanist and humane way, and so forth. We all share these values. And the way we try and realize these values are typically through rights. So there's access to justice and a right to social security and in some countries to housing and to free education. You have a right to education. You have a right to health assistance, etc. We live in a culture of rights. So I looked in the Bible, in the book of Leviticus, chapter 18, chapter 19. That's the place where you find love thy neighbor like yourself. And it's replete with the same ethos of having a system based on justice, taking care of the poor, not maltreating the alien. But there was a striking and fundamental difference to our present-day legal culture, because there are absolutely no rights, only duties. So you don't have a right to social security, you have a duty to help the poor. You don't have a right to sanitary assistance, you have a duty to help the sick. There's no right to life, there's a duty not to take life. So there's a fundamental difference. We read the law not in a positivist sense. We understand that there's a huge cultural difference, and I'm not saying which is better and which is worse, in a society that arranges itself around rights, and biblical society that arranges itself around duties and responsibilities. But you're not. I'm not looking at it as a positivist lawyer. I'm asking something. I'm saying it tells us something important about society when I note that huge difference, that it is a duty, a responsibility-based society rather than a rights-based society. If I'm speaking slowly enough for the translator, will you tell them to raise their hand? Good. So it's in this way that I'm going to look at European Union law. It's in this way that I'm going to look at European Union law. Now, you still read in books about the European Union the following story. The European Union began as an economic project and slowly developed into a political project. That's nonsense. Old wives' tales. In Russian, Bobomyces. Old wives' tales. Nonsense. If you go back and read the preamble to the Treaty of Paris establishing the European Coal and Steel Community, you will see that European integration, from its inception, from the first day, was a political project. The preamble to the Treaty of Paris simply replicated the Schuman Declaration. It was all about politics. It was about reconciling the age-old enmity between France and Germany. That's a political objective. That is a community about politics. It used economic means to achieve political objectives. But I will go even further. There's a very famous aphorism of Jean Monnet. I say it in French. Nous ne coalisons pas des États, nous unissons des hommes. We do not bring states together, we unite human beings. And we realize that the idea of European integration, the project of European integration, and the construct of European integration did not only have a political objective, it had a spiritual dimension. Nous unissons des hommes. We redefine human relation. European integration is an attempt not only to bring states to relate to each other with different disciplines, but also for human beings to relate to each other in a different way within a community. Nous unissons des hommes. It's very much part of the ethos and telos of European integration. Now, make no mistake, both Monnet and Schuman were the masters of realpolitik. They were no dreamers. They believed that if you adopted the correct strategy, it could have a profound impact on human relations, not only at the state level, but also integrating human beings with each other. And it's the success or failure of that moral and spiritual project that I will be examining today. Let's first talk about European values. there have been two cycles of value discourse, of talk about values in Europe. I examined this empirically. You know, the way I did it was very simple. I read all the speeches given by heads of states and government when the country assumed the presidency of the European Union and they went to speak before the European Parliament. Because that's the time that they like to speak about values. And I simply identified what were the most common values which undergird European integration and the European Union. The first trilogy was a direct manifestation of the immediate post-World War, the genocidal Second World War, and the reactions to the excess of nationalism. And the first cycle of three values was peace as a value, prosperity, rebuilding Europe after its destruction. With prosperity comes dignity. And for want of a better word, supranationalism, a different way for states and society to relate to each other. Those were the three values which animated the first two generations of European integration. It's disappearing. I already remember when the Treaty of Maastricht, for some of the young people here, they may not even have been born, was debated, and it was this close to being rejected by a referendum in France. Kohl and Mitterrand went on French television to urge French citizens to vote for the treaty. And they looked into the camera and they spoke about the importance of bridging the enmity between France and Germany forever. And most of the spectators didn't know what they were talking about. That is a measure of the success of the project. That within 35 years, it really obliterated. The generation of Schengen didn't know what they were talking about. That's a good thing. The second thing, the second trilogy, which is more connected to the period when Spain and Portugal joined the community and subsequent, the kind of new holy trinity is democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. For the last 15, 20 years, every head of state, they go to the European Parliament, what are the values that Europe believe in? Democracy, human rights, the rule of law. We stand for democracy, human rights, the rule of law. You hear that again and again. Now, we do not, I think these values are important. I think they are sincerely held. And I think they are the foundation of Europe as an ethical community. It's important. Prosperity is not being rich. Prosperity is also what we do with our money. So solidarity is folded into the notion of prosperity. And on peace I will talk in a minute. I want to translate this into law. I want to translate this into law. So, European Union law has, to a huge degree, unlike the law in some of our member states, also had a rich value discourse. The European Court of Justice again and again engages in value discourse. And the value discourse of European law is a synthesis of these two trilogies of peace, prosperity, supranationalism, democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. There have been three waves. The first wave, the early wave in European legal integration, was the establishment of community rights. When you took obligations among states, and you converted them into rights for individuals. That was a legal revolution. So Holland promises Italy that they will not impose custom duties. You have 1,000 treaties like this in the world, but in the European Union, that creates a right for an individual, a community right for an individual. It's revolutionary. The second wave was human rights. Many of you don't know this. Some of you will have forgotten this. In the original treaties, the Treaty of Paris, the Treaty of Rome, the Single European Act, the word human rights were never mentioned. It's as if the community had no interest in human rights, as if the union had no interest in human rights. Nowhere was it mentioned. And yet, as early as 1969, the European Court of Justice announced that no union measure could be enforced in the union if it was incompatible with the common tradition of human rights in the constitutional order of the member states. That was the second revolution. And today, we are in the midst of a third revolution where we talk about citizens' rights. And if we have time, I will mention it, where the European Court of Justice has said again and again and again, European citizenship is, I'm quoting, is destined to be the fundamental status of nationals of Europe, of European citizens. More about this later. If I synthesize these three waves, community rights, human rights, citizenship rights, what they do is to put the individual at the center. To put the individual at the center. European Union law is individual-centered law. It's not state-centered law. It's individual-centered law, unlike any other international legal regime. And this corresponds to the humanist tradition of Europe, both deriving from the French Revolution and the Enlightenment, and deriving from the Judeo-Christian tradition. So it's fitting that at the center of European law, there will be the individual. Now, we're still in the introduction. Sorry, I warned you. I want to introduce the central conceptual and theoretical foundation of my thesis. And this is where Aristotle, Aquinas, and Maimonides will appear. What puts these three thinkers together is that they understood the distinction between values and virtues in a way which we have forgotten. In political theory today and political discourse today, we hardly ever mention the word virtue. We always speak about values. Do you believe direct in human rights? Of course, that's an important value. Now, let's try and understand the distinction between values and virtues, because it's fundamental to understand the thesis of my presentation here. It's critical bite. I can genuinely say that I uphold the value of speaking the truth. I believe that society is better off if people speak the truth. But then I can go around telling lies. Why? Because I'm not a virtuous person. Because I'm a weak person. Because I yield to temptation. Because I have a tendency to tell lies. Now, I'm not talking about hypocrisy. I'm not talking about somebody who says he believes in family values and then goes to see prostitutes. That's hypocrisy. I'm talking about somebody who in good faith says, I really believe that truth is important. But unfortunately, I tell lies. Value is a collective mores. It is something that is cerebral, that we can argue about. If you're a socialist, your values will reflect that worldview. If you're a conservative, your values will reflect that worldview. One can debate values. One can shape them. I empirically stated the six principal values of European integration. Virtues, both Aristotle, Aquinas, and Maimonides define as individual propensity to act. Individual propensity to act. They are personality traits. Those are the virtues. Now, it's very important something else that they say. They say that virtues are acquired by practice, that virtues can be learned, that virtues can be shaped. It's a little bit like the mental equivalent of physical exercise. If every day you run 2 kilometers, your body will get strong. Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, Maimonides say you can practice your virtues in the way you eat, in the way you talk. They say to parents, you can influence the virtues of your children. They say to society, by example, by the laws you give, you can shape the virtues of people, because it will push them to act in one direction rather than to act in another direction. And that is distinct, I remind you, from values. Because values are the things that we uphold. Virtues define how we act. You can love your country, be a great patriot. That's a value. But in the battlefield, you are a coward. You don't have the virtue of courage. You run away from the enemy. Your country will be defeated. So for the good society, for happiness in the sense that Aristotle or Aquinas or Maimonides define happiness, which is not just I feel happy, but my life is worthwhile, society is a good society, we need a combination of values and virtue. It's not enough that people love their country, they also have to have the virtue of courage. It's not enough that people believe in solidarity and helping the poor. They have to have the virtue of generosity. If you have the values without the virtues, neither at an individual level nor at a societal level will you reach the objectives that virtues define. Now, since my name is Weiler, not Maimonides, not Aquinas, not Aristotle, my project is much more modest. They try to define the virtues, universal virtues, applicable everywhere in every society and for all time. I leave that to them. My project is different. I've identified the values of European integration. Based on the distinction between values and virtues, I want to identify the virtues that are necessary in order to vindicate the values of European integration. Again, I will give you an example. Everybody in the room says, we believe in democracy. Correct? Nobody is going to raise their hand and say, I don't believe in democracy. But it's not enough to have the value of democracy. If democracy is to function, people have to go and vote. People have to stand for public office. If nobody goes and vote, if no good people stand for public office, you won't have democracy even though genuinely you will say, I believe in democracy. You have to have the virtues necessary for democracy to function. Now I come to my thesis. As I said, I do not contest the values of European integration. They are noble. I do not even contest their bona fide. What is my thesis then? My thesis is that some of the structures and processes of European integration, generally, and of European law, more specifically, contribute to a corruption, to an erosion of the virtues we need in order to vindicate the values of European integration. It's a strong thesis. It's European integration working against itself. We believe in democracy, but some of the structures and processes of European integration destroy the virtues needed for democracy. We believe in human rights as a value. Some of the structures and processes of European integration destroy the virtues needed for human rights. You see what I'm saying? I gave a synthesis, and I said European law synthesizes its values by putting the individual at the center. And my thesis claims it puts the individual at the center, but it makes that individual a self-centered individual. So on the one hand, you put the individual in the center, and then you turn him into a self-centered individual. Why is that so dramatic? Because we remember the meta-political value of Jean Monnet. Nous unissons des hommes. We bring about a new type of relationship between human beings. We unite human beings. Self-centered individuals do not unite with each other. Self-centered individuals think about themselves. They don't think about the other. A system which creates self-centered individuals betrays that humanist value which is at the foundation of European integration. And connected to that, it's not only self-centered individual, but individuals who abduct responsibility. In other words, they do not hold themselves responsible for what happens in their society. It's not us, it's these speculators in the markets which is responsible for our problems. That's an example of not taking responsibility but blaming it on somebody else. Or another way of not taking responsibility, I don't like what's happening, somebody should do something about it. Somebody, not myself. That also betrays the values of European integration. So now, that is the thesis. It's simple enough. The practices and structures of European integration corrupt the virtues that are necessary to realize the values. Now I have to, this is the end of the introduction. You understand my method? I look at law as part of culture, not in an instrumental way, and you understand my thesis. There's a difference between values and virtues. Good society needs both values and virtues. It's not enough to love your country. If you run away in the battle, it won't help your country that you love it. It's not enough to love your wife. If you betray her, you don't have the virtue of fidelity. What does it matter that you love her? So the good life requires the combination of the collective value and the personal virtue. And the heart of the thesis, the structures and processes of European integration corrupt the virtues necessary for the values. So now I'm going to try and prove this. At least I'm going to try and illustrate it. I'm not going to illustrate it in relation to all six values. That would take too much time, Director. But I'm going to illustrate it in relation to prosperity, in relation to democracy, and I want to say something about European citizenship. And in a few months, this big paper or short book will be published, and then you can read the examples of the other fields. But you will hear enough, I hope, not to agree with me necessarily, maybe one or two, but I think you will hear enough not to dismiss me, to say we have to think about this. So let me first give the example of prosperity. Prosperity in and of itself, simply being rich, is not a value. What makes it a value, what makes prosperity a value, is that we tie it to solidarity. That we say our prosperity is not just so I individually will be rich, or that my country will be rich, but my prosperity will be part of a society in which we care for the poor, we care for the weak. Or the prosperity of my country will be part of a community or a union where we have solidarity with poor countries. I think that is a noble value. I think people genuinely believe in it. I think the structures of European law militate against realizing really the spirit of solidarity. Why so? The way the law of the market works, European Union market law works, there is negative integration and there is positive integration. Negative integration is what the states may not do to impede the free movement of the factors of production. Free movement of goods, free movement of workers, free movement of capital, free movement of services. So, let's first talk about that. The first thing we note, and we cannot avoid it because it's the premise of what used to be until December of last year, what we used to call the first pillar of the community, the EEC, the European Economic Community, the law of the common marketplace, etc., was of course the ethos of the marketplace, that the best way to create prosperity is to create competition amongst people, and that the most efficient will win the competition and they will become rich, and that will force others to become more competitive, and if you're not competitive, you lose out. It has worked. Our societies have become notably richer. From an economic point of view, the common marketplace, there are of course the ups and downs of capitalism, but if we look not at the last 2 years, but at the last 20 years, or at the last 40 years, or at the last 60 years, there has never been in contemporary European history a period of such sustained growth and prosperity, and a big part of it is because of the competitive conditions which the creation of the common marketplace brought about. But you note that at an individual level, it appeals exactly to the opposite of solidarity. It appeals to our competitive instinct. It appeals to the successful should succeed and the weak and the inefficient should fail. That is the ethos of the common marketplace. That is the ethos of the single market. We don't like to put it so brutally, but that is what drives it. That is what creates the prosperity. I remember when Commissioner Mario Monti, the Commissioner for Competition, he wanted to enshrine that as part of the constitutional principles of the Union. And you remember there was a scandal when Sarkozy tried to pull it out. So although we don't like to look in the mirror and say, that is at the heart of our market law. But I'll give you further for those of you who are interested in the law. If we look at the structure of the law of the market in the European Union, it works this way. You have the basic prohibition. Member states may not interfere with the marketplace. They may not interfere with the free movement of goods. They may not interfere with the free movement of persons. They may not interfere with the free movement of services. Now, sometimes a government wants to interfere for reasons of public morality, public health, public safety, environmental reasons. You follow me? For collective goods, which are there to attenuate the brutal market. The way the treaty is structured is that the default position is the market, the freedom of the market. The exception is morality, environment, safety, health, the human condition. Now, because of this legal structure, it brings about certain legal consequences. First of all, you don't have to prove that it's useful to have a free market. That is the default position. What the state has to prove, and if they don't manage to prove it, they can't act on it, that it is justified in the interest of a competing value to compromise the market. So the default is the market, the exception is the humanist condition, the human condition. And the burden is not to prove the market, but it's to prove the human condition. And then we have a rule of interpretation, and anybody here who studied the law of the European Union will know, we have been teaching our students, following our wonderful European Court of Justice, for 20, 30, 40 years, that every exception to a fundamental freedom has to be interpreted narrowly. The fundamental freedoms in the European Union are not freedom of expression, ladies and gentlemen. They are not freedom of conscience. They are not freedom of religion. The fundamental freedoms are the free movement of the four factors of production, free movement of labor, free movement of goods, free movement of capital. That is what the language of the law says. Those are the fundamental freedoms. Public morality, because it's an exception, has to be interpreted narrowly. The countervailing humanist force in the interest of solidarity has to be interpreted narrowly. It's an interesting cultural artifact that we organize the law of the European Union in a way which privileges competition and privileges the market and exceptionalizes the humanist tradition. Let me give you the second example from the market. We said the market is negative integration, which I've just described, but also positive integration. When the union passes directive, the services directive, the clean beaches directive, any regulation in the interest of achieving a balance between market and other forces. Now here, everybody has heard the principle of subsidiarity, right? And usually it's said, you see, European integration has learned something from Catholic social doctrine, because the principle of subsidiarity was developed in Catholic social doctrine already of the late 19th century, but especially in the 30s. That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen. The only thing in common between the principle of subsidiarity in the European Union and the principle of subsidiarity in Catholic social policy is the word subsidiarity. Everything else, it's not only that they're not alike, they're almost the opposite of each other. And I want to explain to you why this is relevant to my thesis, hugely relevant to my thesis. The principle of subsidiarity in the European Union says, as you will know, that government should be closest to the people affected by it, if possible. So if you can do it at the level of Galicia, the region, it should be done at the level of Galicia. And only if it could be done more effectively at the level of Madrid, it should be done at the level of Madrid. And only if it could be done more efficiently and more effectively at the level of Brussels, it should be done at the level of Brussels. Who can object to that? That is wonderful. I agree with that. But now I want you to notice the secret assumption. The secret assumption of subsidiarity in the European Union is that every problem has to be solved by some level of governance, by some level of government. Never by the individual itself. Never by civil society itself. Every problem, what we look for, who is the appropriate level of government? So, I don't know how to translate this. I hope that I don't give a bad time to the translator. It's solidarity through agency. I'm never engaged in solidarity myself. Always, my solidarity is done by somebody else. The most I do is to pay my taxes. But then, every other problem, subsidiarity will tell me if it's best done by Galicia or by Madrid or by Brussels. But it will tell me whether it's Madrid, Brussels, or Galicia, it's never my responsibility. It's always the responsibility of somebody else to solve the problem. It's a principle of governance. Whereas if you go back, you remove the dust from the books and read Catholic social policy of the 1930s and what they meant by subsidiarity, they meant that people take responsibility for that which is happening around them and feel personally responsible. Now, make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to do away with the welfare state. I don't want to live in a country where there's no social services and hospitals, etc. But I note that the structure of the marketplace of solidarity and prosperity in the European Union de-responsabilizes the individual. De-responsabilizes the individual. So we have the twin concept. It appeals to our competitive spirit. The efficient, the powerful should win. That's the idea of the common market, the common marketplace. It marginalizes the humanist, because that is the exception to the market. And when we act collectively, it is solidarity through agency. It's never a personal responsibility of anybody. The most I do is I open El País in the morning, I read something dreadful happening, and I say to my wife, isn't that terrible? The government ought to do something about it. Let's end that. And let's talk about democracy. Now, here, my thesis can be explained simply enough. First of all, I belong to those people who believe, and I know that in Spain this is difficult, that there is a serious democracy deficit in the European Union. And in a very simple way, I want to try and make you see it and convince you that there really is a serious democracy deficit. How do we explain the democracy deficit? So there are a lot of democratic theories: consociational democracy, liberal democracy, neoliberal democracy, deliberative democracy, social democracy. And there are lots of system of governments: presidential, parliamentarian, bicameral, monocameral, regional, etc. But there is something that is shared by all theories and by all systems. It's the two primordial, primitive principles and practices of democracy. One is the principle of accountability, and the other is the principle of representation. What do I mean by the principle of accountability? The English have a wonderful expression. the ability of the people to throw the scoundrels out. Today they're going to do it. Probably. To say, I am tired of this government, I'm going to throw them out, and there will be another government. You are accountable once in 4 years, once in 5 years, once in 6 years, whatever the practice is. The people get the chance to throw the scoundrels out, to change their government. In Europe, we have governance, for sure. Do you remember? Jacques Delors said by the end of the millennium, 80% of social legislation will come out of Brussels. Maybe 70%, maybe 85%. But that's the ballpark. There is governance. A huge amount of issues are decided in Brussels. But there is no government. So there is no moment in the civic life of the European Union where if enough citizens go and vote in a certain way, they can throw the scoundrels out. It just doesn't exist. Because there is no government. The Commission is not a government. The Council is not a government. It's a funny system of governance. The principle of representation means if enough people vote in the same way, it will influence policy. Their voter preference will be expressed in what politicians do. So, not a huge difference, but if Mr. Zapatero is Prime Minister, the policies are somewhat different than if Mr. Aznar is Prime Minister. One is center-right, one is center-left. So, different system of taxation, etc. There is no moment in the life of the European Union where if enough citizens vote in the same way, that will be reflected in the policies and laws and norms passed by the European Union. Today we have a conservative majority in the European Parliament. It will have no impact whatsoever on what comes out of Brussels. And they're going to change President of Parliament. It's not just a democracy deficit, it's a political deficit. The Commission prides itself of not being political in a party political way. I can go on about this for a long time. The two most basic, primitive, primordial norms of our democracies, shared in all our member states, accountability, you can throw the scoundrels out. Representation, you can shape by your vote the policies that the governors do not apply in the European Union. And yet, it's been very successful in achieving its objective. And that's the problem. It's success. Why? Because its success breeds legitimation through results rather than legitimation through process. And democracy is legitimation through process, not through results. So it corrupts our democratic sensibility. It corrupts our civic virtues. Why should I care to go and vote for the European Parliament? The more power Parliament has received, the less people go and vote for it. Why should I care? I don't make a difference anyway. They seem to be succeeding. Let's go on. Do you think the Treaty of Lisbon cures the democratic deficit? Think again. But it was passed by all our parliaments. That is a sign of the corruption of our civic sensibilities. We are more and more, and it spills over into our national politics. We are more and more willing to accept legitimation through results rather than legitimation through process, through participation in a real republican democratic polity. I will conclude by talking about European citizenship. There didn't used to be European citizenship. until 17, 18 years ago, Maastricht introduced it. An invention of Felipe González. He smelled that wily old fox that the Maastricht Treaty was not going to be very popular. So he said, let's do something that will mobilize public opinion. And he said, let's invent European citizenship. That will make them feel part of Europe. Nice thought. So European citizenship was introduced. Until European citizenship was introduced, what we had were nationals of the member states, which had certain rights under the treaties. European citizenship said, nationals of the member states are hereby European citizens. European citizenship should complement and not replace national citizenship. European citizens should be subject to the rights and duties herein specified, and of course, no duties were specified. So, to begin with, European citizenship is a concept of rights with no duties. That is different from the way we understand citizenship in our member states, where citizenship is typically associated both with rights and duties. Secondly, there have been now many court cases on European citizenship. And what the European Court of Justice has done is to take its case law on free movement of workers, of migrant workers, and now it couches it as a case law on European citizenship. It is a fundamental mistake, and I want to explain to you why. The case law on free movement of workers had two complementary strands. One said, migrant workers may not be discriminated on grounds of nationality. You cannot treat a Spanish worker in France worse than you treat a French worker in wages, in insurance, in whatever. The principle of non-discrimination. But then the court went further and it says migrant workers do not only have the right not to be discriminated against, they have special community rights. Community rights which nationals of the country in which they are may not even have. In fact, we call that in French discrimination à rebours, reverse discrimination. And maybe it's justified, because the migrant worker is vulnerable, he's living away from his home, he's in a different culture and he's a different country, so we ought to give him extra protection. So we give the migrant worker extra protection. Those are the community rights, including discrimination à rebours, reverse discrimination. Now, the court takes that case law and says, European citizenship has even deepened our commitment. So the duty of non-discrimination is enhanced, and the community rights that the migrant worker gets are also enhanced. I'll give you an example. There is a Spanish migrant worker in Belgium. He is living there now all his life. His children are there, they are growing up in Belgium. His child is born, his name is Diego. His father wants to call him, in the Spanish way, Diego Garcia Avelo. Father's name, mother's name. The Belgian authorities say no. He's born in Belgium, he's a Belgian citizen now. In Belgium, you cannot give two names to your child, either the name of the father or the name of the mother. This is also true for Belgians. There are lots of couples who want to give their children two names. We don't allow it. Why? In the interest of public order, it can be confusing, etc. Chacun a son goût, everybody to his taste. Diego Garcia Vela, or the father of Diego, goes to court, and it goes to the European court, and he says, I'm a migrant worker, this is my son, and if he is not allowed to be called officially on his birth certificate Diego Garcia Vela, he will suffer bad consequences when he goes to Spain. There will be all kinds of benefits and things which he will not be able to get if he is only Diego Garcia or Diego Avela instead of Diego Garcia Vela. Whether right or wrong, that's what it's claimed and that's what the court accepts. And the court says, absolutely right, there's no reason, you have to allow him, he's the son of a migrant worker, you have to allow him. And now he's not only a son of a migrant worker, he's a European citizen. So therefore, you must allow him, even though he's in Belgium, to be called Diego Garcia Vela. That's the case. I want to explain to you, even though you might be sympathetic to Diego Garcia Vela, why this is a profoundly disquieting case. And it's a profoundly disquieting case if it's couched in the vocabulary of European citizenship. It's how we think about it that matters rather than the result. There really is a difference between a citizen and a migrant worker. A migrant worker is somebody who goes to another country to work, to earn money, to establish himself. But the idea is that his real country, he remains Spanish. He wants to go back to Spain. He wants his children to think of himself, of themselves as Spanish. And therefore, it makes sense that community law should give him the possibility to maintain that kind of identity. So there are provisions that they have to provide schools which will teach him in the Spanish language, and he should be called Garcia Vela and not follow the Belgian practice, etc. It all makes sense if you are a migrant worker. Not. But if you are a citizen who is not exercising your right as a migrant worker, but is exercising your right under the citizenship clause to live and reside freely in any country. So you move from Spain, and now you live in Belgium, and you raise your children in Belgium. How should we treat you? Now, I'm going to give you my view, my normative view. And you'll see in a minute why I think this is so important. My view is to say, you're a European citizen, we welcome you. Come and live with your family among us. And if you're Spanish or Portuguese or Latvian or Estonian, you come and live among us and we will change a little bit. Because you will be introducing some of your cultural habits and your cuisine and etc. And if we are a Protestant country and you are Catholic, of course, you should be able to practice your religion freely. Even though we in Denmark, if you come to Denmark, are officially a Lutheran country. Catholics are welcome. Or we in Britain are officially a Church of England, an Anglican country, Protestant. Catholics are welcome. No problem. And we won't discriminate you. And we really want to share our lives with you. But you don't only have rights, you have duties too. And your most important duty is not a legal duty. Your most important duty is to teach your children. We come from Spain, we're proud of it, we have family there, I always want you to speak Spanish, but now our new home is in Denmark, or in Belgium, or in Britain. And we become part of this society. And we have to be good citizens, and I want you to feel that this is our new home. For me, it's difficult. I spent 30, 40 years in Spain. Now this is difficult for me. But for you, this is our home. They embrace us, and we embrace them. What the court does, by contrast, by taking the case law on migrant workers and unthinkingly transferring it to European citizenship, it creates a ghetto of migrant workers. It gives an incentive to the migrant worker not to integrate, because then he will lose all his special rights. And more profoundly, it teaches him never to think of himself as part of his new country, and it teaches the new country never to think of them as part of their country, but as migrant workers, which we have to treat without discrimination. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I wouldn't care so much if the problem is Diego Garcia Vera in Belgium. We can survive it, whatever we decide. But that's not the problem of immigration that we're facing. The problem of Spanish going to Belgium and wanting to call his kid Diego Garcia Vera. The Court of Justice and jurisprudence, the ethos that it reflects, becomes the model how we think of immigrants. I want to be able, for example, to turn to the Muslim immigrants in our society, the legal ones, and say to them, you are welcome. And unlike Switzerland, you can have your mask. And we will not discriminate against you. But you have to teach your children that this is their new country. What we will not tolerate is migrant communities coming here and saying, as long as I pay taxes and don't break the law, you can leave me alone. I don't belong to you. If that's how you want to be here, thank you, but no thank you. You're a guest worker. But if you want to be here and make your home, it comes not only with rights, it comes also with duties. My attitude towards you has to be reciprocated by your attitude towards me. The jurisprudence of citizenship of the European Court of Justice does exactly the opposite. Instead of nous unissons des hommes, we unite people, in a strange, paradoxical, unintended ways, it keeps them apart. Instead of integrating Diego Garcia Vela into his new country, Belgium, we teach him, you are not really Belgium. And we are teaching the Belgians, he is not really Belgian. And this could be for the son of Diego, the grandson of the original migrant worker. He will also continue. That's not good. That's not uniting people. That is separating people. That is a model of treating well guest workers who come, earn money, and then leave. It's not a model of citizenship of people who are moving to a new country to make their new home there. It's not good for Spanish migrants, and it's not good for Maghreb, Moroccan, Senegalese migrants. It betrays the metapolitical objective. It's not the virtue that we need in order to have the value of uniting people. Now, I could continue on and show how similar processes operate in human rights and operate in the rule of law and in the other series, but I think you have gotten the idea of my thesis, and I thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for your patience.
Muchas gracias, profesor Weiler, por su docta y profunda intervención que nos ha hecho pensar en nuestras raíces y en nuestra forma de vida cotidiana en un mundo globalizado y un mundo y una sociedad como la comunitaria, en donde tenemos que convivir con otras sociedades. Abrimos ahora un turno de preguntas. Por si alguien quiere formular alguna, que yo creo que sería bueno que se formulase, ya que disponemos del profesor Weiler. Sí. Gracias.
Yo quisiera, bueno, obviamente me ha parecido muy interesante su reflexión, con la que coincido prácticamente, pero quisiera hacer un pero. Las cuestiones que plantea, esas enormes diferencias entre valores, virtudes, entre ciudadano europeo y ciudadano local, ¿no?, o meramente nacional, hay una enorme distancia cultural respecto a esas virtudes, a los tiempos de Aristóteles, Aquino y Maimónides. Quiero decir, ¿cómo se podría verdaderamente revertir ese proceso que parece imparable y que no sabemos a dónde nos puede llevar?
You see, I'm not suggesting that we all have to buy Nicomachean Ethics or The Guide to the Perplexed by Maimonides or go back to Aquinas and look up their virtues and adopt them in our life. I think what is important is to realize that it is not enough to believe in something, to adopt certain values, but that values without virtues, without courage, are useless. And then we have to develop the virtues that are important in contemporary life for the values that we believe in. I'll give you an example. One of the most shocking experiences we've had in Europe was the genocide in Bosnia. Who would have believed that in the second half of the 20th century, Europe would allow for a second time a genocide against a religious minority to take place? But it happened. The World Court in The Hague defined it as genocide. So now, let's understand what happened. At a collective level, we demonstrated that we were not serious about the values we professed. We were not serious in a long term and in a short term. We were not serious in a long term because we did not equip ourselves to protect the values we believe in. So when the decision was taken that the only way to protect the Kosovars was to use force, Europe discovered that it didn't have the force that was needed to protect them. They had to get the cowboys. Europe didn't even have the capacity to target. Italy provided an airport and was very proud of it. Spain provided 6 airplanes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They had about 30 to 40 sorties. The French had about 300 sorties, the British about 800 sorties, the American 20,000. That is not a serious commitment to protect the most fundamental value. European integration was premised this could never happen again in our continent. And it happened 120 kilometers from Rome. That's at the collective level. Also at the collective level, we showed ourselves incapable of deciding. You remember Lord David Owen going around and around and talking and talking and people being killed and more being killed and more being killed and talking and talking and talking. And eventually the decisive decision was taken in Dayton, Ohio. How can that be? It's Europe, it's us, it's not an American business. Now let's look at the individual level, Srebrenica. So we have these Dutch soldiers. They were not fascists, they were not Nazis. They were exactly like you and I. They believe in human rights. They believe in human dignity. What was their failing? They were cowards. Vigliacchi in Italian. They were brought up in a culture which taught them that nothing is so important that it is worth killing for or being killed for. Not even if you see 20,000 people being tortured, raped, and murdered. Even for that, you do not risk your life. You don't need Aquinas for that. You don't need Aristotle for that. You don't need Maimonides for that to understand that to talk about peace and liberty and democracy and human rights, but not to have the resolve to vindicate them at a collective and at an individual level, which is exactly what we call virtue, makes it empty. Makes it empty. Ultimately, both collectively and individually, here was an example where we acted egoistically, putting our self-interest rather than acting virtuously to show a commitment to the values we profess to believe in. We don't need Aquinas for that.
Thank you. Gracias. Sí, allá al fondo, por favor.
Muchas gracias, profesor. Siendo un experto como es en la integración europea y en tantos otros temas, no puedo resistir la tentación de preguntarle cómo cree que debe articularse la integración europea en los países del entorno de Europa. Esto es, ¿cómo ve la relación, por ejemplo, con los países de Rusia o su hinterland, Bielorrusia, Ucrania, o cómo la vería con Turquía, una posible integración, o incluso con una mayor aproximación a los países de la otra orilla del Mediterráneo, el Magreb, el norte de África y el Medio Oeste? Muchas gracias.
So, we should not engage in a modern version of imperial fantasies. Russia, the Ukraine, the Maghreb, North Africa, etc. Europe is reaching the limits of its capacity to even have a semblance of democracy with the size that it has now. You must all understand there is a relationship between size and democracy. The more people you add to the polity, the less becomes the specific gravity of each individual. In Athens, every individual could go and talk and shape in the agora, etc., because the numbers were small. When polities grew, we shifted to representative democracy rather than direct democracy, and to all kinds of federal structures, etc. But at a certain point, these begin to fail us, because the structures become formal, but the individual never feels that he or she already heard that they can really be influential, etc. So we have to be realistic and somber and modest in our growth. There can be many other models to cooperate with the countries around the Mediterranean. I mean, the Mediterranean policy was launched with many trumpets here in Spain, but not much was done after that. And to think about the Ukraine or Russia, oh, please, I mean, that would be a plot of the anti-marketeers to really destroy the European Union. So even talking about it creates problems, wrong expectations, wrong fears, etc. Turkey is a different issue. Turkey, unlike North Africa, is in some part of Europe. Turkey, the European Union promised that they were a candidate member state. So there's something in life still called honor and nobility. We made a promise to them many years ago. There can be many reasons, good reasons, why Turkey could, it would be a wise thing to have Turkey in the European Union. Like Spain and Portugal, I hate to say this, it would help consolidate democracy there. It would be an interesting mediating state between Europe and the Islamic world. There, it would bring stability on that border of an area where Europe has seen much grief over the decades and over the centuries. There are many reasons not to bring Turkey in. Its political culture, its state of economic development. What I said before, it would be the biggest member states, it would add around 100 million people, and with a growth rate which is pretty effective, so growing, we could say at 400 million we have to stop. I do not know how to resolve that debate, but I know to say one thing categorically. The one reason that is totally illegitimate to refuse Turkish entry is the fact that they are Muslim. Because that betrays everything Europe claims to believe in. Liberty, human rights, democracy, etc. That is atavism. It saddens me because I think that if Turkey does not enter, and I have no dog in that race, I really think there are good reasons yes and good reasons no. But I fear that if Turkey does not come in, the reason will be that atavism. Simply, we don't want these Muslims. That's, you know, mamma li Turchi. In Italy, when you want to frighten your children, you don't say, I will call a policeman, mamma, li Turchi vengono. So, I would not like to educate my children on the notion that because somebody does not share my faith, they have no place in my community. That would be a betrayal of what Europe stands for. So if the decision is not to allow Turkey in, I hope it's for the right reason and not for that wrong reason.
Muchas gracias. ¿Alguna intervención? Sí, gracias. Sí,
gracias. Y vamos a ver, volviendo, profesor, a esta cuestión que se planteaba ahora con relación a Turquía y su integración en la Unión Europea, yo no creo que sea exclusivamente por una razón de carácter religioso. Yo creo que Europa, a lo largo de estos últimos años, desde luego desde que la Unión Europea funciona como tal, en cuanto a materia de tolerancia religiosa, creo que ha ido incluso en ocasiones más allá de lo que la propia razón podría aconsejar. Es decir, me parece reducir excesivamente el problema de la integración de Turquía al problema religioso, me parece hacer un cierto reduccionismo de un problema que tiene una dimensión mucho mayor y que tiene que ver, pues bueno, pues con el peso que tendría Turquía, por ejemplo, en cuanto al sistema de votación y toma de decisiones en la Unión Europea, la posición geoestratégica que podría ocupar Turquía y la resolución de determinados problemas en el área de Asia Menor, etcétera. En definitiva, aunque así fuera, y esta es la pregunta que yo quería formularle, aunque así fuera, no estamos en presencia, en el caso de Turquía, de un problema de integración religiosa en una comunidad mayoritariamente cristiana, sino que estaríamos en presencia de la integración de alguien, un Estado, que en cierto modo, a pesar de que el carácter laico del mismo está establecido así desde su fundación moderna y así consta en su constitución, tiene cada vez una mayor presencia de un islamismo combativo, vamos a decirlo así. Y yo creo que ese es el verdadero temor que en estos momentos existe en la Unión Europea, que por una parte nos encontramos con unas sociedades que son tolerantes frente a diferentes formas de vivir la religión y unas sociedades que pretenden integrarse en ellas y aprovecharse de sus sistemas de libertades, etcétera, pero manteniendo criterios religiosos que en definitiva no hacen más que combatir los cimientos de la propia en los cuales se basa la propia sociedades occidentales. Yo me encantaría, si es posible, oír algún comentario suyo a este respecto. Gracias.
I think in the first part of what you said, we actually agree with each other. I said there can be many reasons we might decide it's not a good idea to have Turkey, which have nothing to do with the fact that they're Muslim. Their size, political culture, economic development, etc. All I said is that I fear that if the decision is taken that it's not worthwhile having him, it will not be for those good, serious reasons, which I agree with you are serious reasons. I don't know where the trade-off is, but there are serious reasons. I fear that it will be because of some atavistic reticence. They are Muslim, they cannot be part of us. Now, the second part of what you're saying, I think Europe should be bold here. Europe should say, we have no tolerance for the intolerant. Right? Like the German constitution. We have no tolerance for the intolerant. We cannot accept radical Islam. We cannot accept militant Islam. Europe should also say, we have certain values like gender equality, like human dignity, that everybody has to subscribe to, every member state has to subscribe to, including Turkey. If Turkey subscribes to those values, and there is a version of Islam that is not militant, if Turkey subscribes to those values, and is willing to abide by them like other member states of the European Union, then I do not see the fact that they go to a mosque and you go to a church and I go to a synagogue should make a difference whether or not they can be a good member state. I do not see the fact that you believe in the Holy Trinity, I believe in the one and only Almighty God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Muslims believe in the Prophet Muhammad, that should be a reason that they should not be here. If they are willing to subscribe and practice the values which we all share, which are reflected in the European Convention on Human Rights, which are reflected in our democratic structures, then that cannot be a reason that they should not be that difference. Now, there are people who will say that's a good reason to bring them in because it would consolidate that version of Islam. It would consolidate Turkey as a secular state. It would consolidate the tendency of Turkey away from that kind of militants. And there are those who say it's all bluff and some kind of Trojan horse. I cannot judge that, but it's that what I cannot accept, and maybe we have to agree to disagree, I cannot accept that in principle they can be excluded just because it's a country where the majority of the people hold another monotheistic faith. Doesn't square with my idea of Europe. Don't forget, I'm a Jew. Until the 19th century, the Christian Europe said that Jews could not be citizens because they were Jewish. I always say that the Germans have to thank Spain for expelling the Jews in this country, and not only they could not be citizens, they were not allowed to live here because of their religion. To your eternal detriment, I'm just joking. So, I don't see why holding another faith, if people subscribe to our civic values, why that should be an impediment.
Muchas gracias, profesor Weiler. ¿Alguna pregunta más? Entonces voy a formular yo la última, muy breve. ¿Qué cree, profesor Weiler, que España puede y debe aportar a la integración europea?
Now I'm really going to put the cat among the pigeons. So sometimes I think I'm a bigger Spanish patriot than many of my many Spanish friends. I come to Spain 3 or 4 times every year. Look, if you would ask anybody in Europe, what are the 3 most important countries in a global historical sense in Europe? Everybody except in Spain and except the Spanish would say that is England, France and Spain. Nobody in Spain would include Spain, but everybody else in the world would say England, France and Spain. These are the 3 countries that have shaped the world. If you asked anybody what is the 2nd most important language in the world, everybody except in Spain would say Spanish. You are Spanish citizens, I'm a visitor here, but you are special, your citizenship, because you don't own this country. You are custodians of this country. It's been so important in Western civilization. So fundamental in Western civilization that you are trustees, you are custodians. You have to preserve it for all of us. Take good care of it. It's not yours to do with it what you want. It's too important a world patrimony. So you know the direction I'm going. The direction I'm going is that, okay, there you have this history that nobody can shake off of the years of Francoism. And in the multicultural sensibility, people also turn away from the great epoch of Spanish imperialism and colonialism, etc. So for many of my Spanish students, Spanish history begins with the transición. We had a wonderful transición. What happened before that? I don't know, I don't want to know. If I know, I am embarrassed about it. Who wants to talk about it? Cortés was a criminal, Franco even bigger. No memory. No community, no ethical community. It's a funny thing that young people here do not have pride in Spanish civilization, they only have pride in Spanish football. And now all this would be trivial, except that the constitutional situation in this country is starting with the constitutional settlement with the Basques, already with the original constitution of the transition, and then the Statute of the Autonomy, which I consider as a constitutional, comparative constitutional lawyer and an expert in federalism, a disaster. A simple disaster. It's a return to the 1920s, Statute of Minorities, a conviction that One cannot have a nation, a single nation, which is composed of components. It's just so much is wrong with the spirit behind it, I say as a scientist. And then to my dismay, I see that other regions are adopting the same model, Andalusia, etc. Now, contrary to what many people think, it is possible to make irreversible constitutional mistakes. It is possible to make irreversible constitutional mistakes. Once the toothpaste is outside of the tube, you cannot put it back in again. Try. It's out, you cannot put the toothpaste in. Look what has happened to Belgium. Belgium kept giving more autonomy and more autonomy to the regions, thinking just, you know, let's give him the thumb and then this finger and then this finger and then the whole hand. And now that country is basically on the point of dissolution, and it would disintegrate in two inconsequential little midgets, Wallonia and Flanders, if they didn't have the problem of how to divide the spoils of Brussels. So you ask me, Director, what Spain can contribute to European integration? The biggest contribution could be a victory of the spirit to show that despite the fact that one can might speak different languages, after all, they speak different languages in Switzerland, and despite the fact that one has historical gripes because in a certain period, which is this big in your long history, right? Oppressed, or you were not oppressed, etc., that you have the spiritual greatness, the political courage, and the social wisdom to maintain the historical Spain intact and not to succumb to tribalism and sort of the primitive notion of nationalism as Europe lived with the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. That would be a really important contribution to Europe. If historical Spain cannot keep intact, what future does Europe have? Thank you.
Thank you. Muchas gracias. Muchas gracias, profesor Weiler, por su intervención. Muchas gracias a todos ustedes, autoridades que no he mencionado con anterioridad, señores consejeros de Agricultura y vicepresidente de la Xunta de Galicia, señor director de la Escuela Gallega de Práctica Jurídica, compañeros, amigos, gracias por asistir a este acto. Creo que ha merecido la pena y prometemos salir, desde luego salimos más reforzados en nuestros valores y prometemos, señor Weiler, ejercitar nuestras virtudes. Muchas gracias.